So today is February 6, 2014. It's Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing on our journey through Dave's life. And looking back at my notes from when we left off back in December, you had finished talking about being at Wild Lake, and that takes us back to leaving Alaska and going back down to Connecticut, correct?
Right.
Take it away.
Okay, so I was had to stay over winter because I didn't have enough money to go back to Connecticut, but I was knew I had to go back to and go to the university. So I had already corresponded, and they said because my high school grades were C average that I would have to take exams, even though I was a resident technically of Connecticut, to go to the University of Connecticut. But I was gung-ho now. I knew what I wanted to do and had the motivation and had taken a couple of courses here at the University of Alaska here in college at Fairbanks. And interest courses, but also bonehead courses to improve my math that I had. Algebra, I remember I hadn't done very well in high school and figured I better do all those, improve those a bit, which I did. So I had this Model A Ford, which was up on blocks most of the winter, and then got that into going condition and was ready to leave just about the 1st of June after a breakup. But, what happened? That was a big flood year in Fairbanks.
And so, what year was that?
1948. And so it was a spring breakup. And not only here, but it was all along the highway. I drove downtown a few times, and you had to drive really slow because you were driving in water about 10 inches deep. And they didn't want to make waves because the sandbags around the railroad station and the other places to keep the water from going into the basements as much as possible. And the road highway was closed because it washed out in several places by on the way to Delta. And then in Yukon territory, the bridges were washed out. So we were late about 10 days before the water subsided enough, which is, you know, when you got a long trip like that ahead of you, that was frustrating. I had two students who wanted to ride with me and share the gas prices, which was a great deal. And one of them was, I can't recall his name, and the other one was a woman, I'll think of her name too. She was upper division, junior or senior, and she was really a tall, attractive woman who was engaged to another student and was athletics. And this other guy lived in Portland, Oregon. So the plan was he would ride down as far as that. She would go down, I forgot where she was from. I think it was the West Coast, her family. And she was going out because her sister was going to get married and she wanted to be out for the marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think it might have been Seattle or it might have been someplace else, Portland or someplace. So we took off. They got the roads temporarily repaired. We made it to Whitehorse, and then the road was closed because they still hadn't repaired a major bridge. They had to put down pilings, you know, and build the whole bridge from scratch again. And so they said, "It'll be a couple of days," and that was. And we had a tent. We camped out, And that was really interesting in town because they were getting ready to launch these riverboats at their Whitehorse.
Right.
And about the second day we were there, we heard, that's going to be exciting because you get them all ready and there's a big turnout of people to watch it, and they have they're on these skids down into the river, and everything is teamwork, and the workers are there, and then they have these wooden chocks that are keeping the boat there while they were working on it or until the ice went out, and they get everything ready to go, and the boat's all ship-shape, and then they time this thing. They blow a whistle, and they knock. It takes about three of them because it's so long on the skids. They knock those blocks out at the same time with the sledgehammer, and then they start sliding slowly down. They gain a little momentum, and they go right into the water, and it's a wave. Not a big one, but a wave, and there's a cheering and everything.
It's exciting, yeah.
So they did two of the riverboats, and that was exciting. And Whitehorse was a unique place, like Fairbanks was in those days. I mean, probably even more unique. And so, we enjoyed being there. The weather was nice and camped out, and you could get food and stuff. And then I'll have to admit, I was getting more and more attracted to this gal, and she to me, I think. And then, when they weren't getting the bridge done, she wasn't going to make it if she went with us in time for the wedding. So she telegraphed her parents, and they sent her some money to fly it down, which was, there weren't many flights from Whitehorse, but he was able to do that. So we had to see her off. I thought, maybe in the long run, that's best. Because our lives were going in different directions. And so Ed something or other was the guy that was with me. And he was a good guy, very quiet, and we got along fine. But then we had no trouble coming up the year before, no major problems. We had one flat tire all the way from Connecticut up, and there was a nail, and we got that straightened out. And going down, we're driving along, and suddenly it stops hitting on four cylinders, only three. And so I pulled over, and you're out there in the middle of wilderness, with no facilities or services to speak of. And I knew this engine well and did all the diagnosis, and I couldn't figure out for a while. And I said, probably must be valve. And so we took off the, undid the spark plug, and I had this other guy hold in there. We disengaged the other spark plug so it wouldn't fire. And then I turned over the engine with a crank, which we had, in front slowly. And I wanted him to feel whether the valves were going up and down. He could do that after a little trial and error. And the valves were all going up and down. And then he said, but the piston isn't going up and down. Well, I couldn't understand how that could be possible, because you're turning over this thing, the crankshaft, all these pistons are going up and down as you turn it over. This one piston that wasn't firing was not. There was a spark there, but there was a problem when and so. We figured, that's something's wrong there. But it wasn't a major crisis in terms of you'd know if it was a major problem, you would have had all the metal grinding and stuff like that. We didn't have that, it just stopped running. So we took the head off. You have to have a gasket and stuff. And and had all the tools, and we saw what the problem was, that the top of the piston, which has it made out of aluminum, and had a ring where you have rings in, and it had broken, the top had broken off right at one of those rings. So the rest of the piston was going up and down, and it pushed this up to the top, and it just sit there.
It was disconnected.
It was disconnected. So that's why it wasn't working, but I figured, well, we're going to have to go on three cylinders, looks like, till we can get it someplace where we can get another piston put in there. And we were still hadn't reached the highest point on the highway. And I figured, well, man, you know, we'd have to gear down with three cylinders to make it up the hills. And so I tried to psych out the whole thing. I said, okay, well, we want that to be closed. So we wanted to take that piece out because if it twisted, it could break and get behind and destroy the engine. So, and the others was going up and down fine without the top on it. But it couldn't work because it was open. So figured, well, probably the problem was you would get gases coming back in there, mm-hmm. and then they would fire through the manifold, and you could get a slow burn, you know, sounded like a train letting off a steam. So we took that out, and then I cut a piece of metal can and put it right there to cover it up, so it's this metal there, and then put the gas set down and put the whole thing on, and then disengage the spark plug so it wouldn't fire, and then we took off. Well, we didn't go very far when we got a backfire through the manifold, mm-hmm. and that pressure blew that thing. It twisted it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's just thin metals, so that's not a big deal if it's up there. And the engine still ran on three cylinders. But you'd go for about 5 miles, and then, you know, you could gear down if you were on level or slightly downhill, and it'd go along at a pretty good speed. But any grade, you had to ship down, and steep grades, you had to go to the lowest and just plug away to get up the hill. And so we made it up to the top, and there was a gas station there, and you know, there was a possibility they might be able to do something, but it was only gas, and they didn't know anything about anything else. And so they said the best bet is Fort Nelson, which was down the highway quite a ways, but it was downhill going into British Columbia, and where they had a airstrip and a post office, mm-hmm. and a trading post, and there's a garage there, a good garage there. And so we took off. And so it wasn't too bad going downhill. But it was every 5 miles, you'd get this some of these oil fumes from the crankcase mixing with the gas, and then a backfire, and it would you know sound like a steam engine letting off. It would ignite, and you look in the rearview mirror, and this big cloud of smoke would come out, and after 100 yards or so, the engine's still running. It's all taken care of until another 5 miles, and you get enough of this explosive stuff. But it was still going, and we didn't have any other alternatives, really.
So when you say you gear down and you're running on three cylinders, you just have to drive slower? Is that...
If you're going uphill, you definitely do.
Yeah.
But if you're going on the level, no. You couldn't go too fast on the highway anyway.
Right.
So we got there to Fort Nelson, and there was this gas station right there as you turned into the village off the highway, and it was closed, and there was a sign on it saying closed. And so we went in and to the trading post and post office, and we told them our problem, and that they said, well, the guy that runs the gas station is on a drunk. He's down in his cabin, probably sleeping, and chances are you could use his ramp outside if you asked him, and he might even, he's a good guy, he might even loan your tools or if you need them. And but yeah, you obviously, probably your best bet is to telephone the Ford dealer in Edmonton and tell them what you need, the cylinder, and they can ship it up on the mail plane, which was due in about 3 days or something like that. So I was on the alternative. We did that, called them. They helped us get through on the telephone lines, and they had, for that Model A Ford, then they had replacement cylinder and rings, and sent it up. It would come up on the mail plane. They checked on that. Of course, they were used to doing these kind of things in those days. So we hung around, and then finally arrived pretty close to on schedule, like 3 days later or something. And of course, we were already late getting out.
Right.
But at any rate, we got it, went down there, and we'd also contacted this guy that was on drunk, and and we pretty much had tools that we needed. We might have borrowed one or two, but it was right in the peak of mosquito season. Yep. Now. It was terrible. And you're on this outdoor ramp, and you'd be down there, and your hands were all greasy, and mosquitoes, you just had to rub them off. And we had something like citronella, it was the only thing we had, which wasn't very effective. That was pretty rough. But we toughed it out, and this Ed was handy to tell, to help when you need two people, and it was he was a good guy. He wasn't too good a mechanic, but he was a good guy. And so he got it apart, put it back together again, and put the gasket back on, and hope that when you took that off, you want to be careful you didn't destroy that, because we didn't have a new gasket. But we did it, and I had some that special sealant, and put it back together and started up and took off again. And so then we went down, then it was running fine again. The big problem then on is the brakes on that Model A Ford. It had levers that were separate axle between the front wheels, and then another one between the back wheels, and then there were rods, and there was a bar that stuck up there, so that when you push down on the brakes in the car, you were pushing. There was no hydraulic or anything like that then. Mm-hmm. It was just press. Harder you push, the harder it would squeeze the brake deals. But if you're going fast, it would. You couldn't stop very quickly, but you could stop. And but the problem was that, and if you're coming downhill or something, and it wouldn't stop, and you were it was just a weight, and we weren't going very fast, and you pushed so damn hard, then bingo, you'd break one of these arms. It was cast iron. And then you were in bad way, because then the back wheels, if it was the front wheel, the back wheel brakes would work, and the front wheels would just pull on that one side, and that was on a gravel road. That's a disaster. You start spinning right away. And loose gravel or muddy, and so then you have to get under there and disconnect the front and deal with only the back wheels, which none of them were all that good to begin with. So then you had to learn to gear down when you're coming downhill and slow way down, put it in low gear, and then gradually apply the brakes. And even then, it took you a long distance to slow down to a stop. Well, then we got down, got through the British Columbia and into maybe a little bit of Alberta, and went into Idaho International Falls was the next town. And by that time, the breaks were so bad, and we have these steep hills, and we had all these mountains now to go through. And so we had to stop and get them to weld these things back together. They could do that. But we're, you know, the cost is a factor too. We didn't have all that much money to make it all the way back to
right.
Connecticut. And so we stopped, and that was, the engine was starting to knock.
Mm.
And it was a different kind of knock than it was valves. And so we stopped at a nice guy's at a replay place, and there was only one in the town, I think. It wasn't a very big town then. And so they could do the welding, and we said, well, what did it cost us to do? Well, they said, we asked them, well, what's this knocking noise? And they listened, and they said, well, you probably need some valve work, too. And then it might be the main bearing.
Uh-oh.
And the cheapest thing just to do a valve job would have been, and it would have been 3 days or so, it would be like $200. I didn't have that kind of money. So I figured I got to make it to Spokane, and then the realistic thing is to sell the car and take a bus back home. And Spokane was pretty close to Portland, so the guy could make it home on the bus from there. So that's what it did. And it was disappointing because I was getting attached to this Roadster, but I didn't have much of the options. And so then someplace you could drive up by close to a gas station, and you could park your car there and put a for sale sign on it. And you had to be there, sit around, and wait, maybe someone would stop. So it took me a couple of days after Ed had taken the bus, and I didn't have a clue, you know, whether it was going to sell or not, but I didn't have any other alternatives. And finally, some guy stopped, and he wanted, because the body was really top-notch, and it was a top that you could put down, it was still in good condition, and it was a nice looking thing. Some guy that wanted to work on the motors, it was a good deal. I sold it for about $200, which was, if I had gotten it back to Connecticut and got it fixed, I could have sold it probably for $500. But at any rate, I had to do that and and bought a ticket, a Greyhound ticket, and went. I still wanted to stop at Yosemite National Park and one other one there in California, and yeah, the Redwoods and
Sequoia Kings Canyon.
Yeah, and then it went through the South, which wasn't the greatest because in New Orleans the temperature was about 100,
yeah,
and the humidity terrible, and I stayed in the cheapest hotel I could find, and it was you had to open the window, and there was no air conditioning, and you had all this noise, and you just sweat, you know. On the buses, it wasn't so bad because you're moving in and get air movement. And so then I got back that. So I made it back and then got a job at a family dairy that were doing all of the processing, delivery of milk, et cetera, and worked there for the remainder of the summer. And then that was not too far from the university. And then my mother and sister and her husband and family were living together in the hometown. And I'd get home there on weekends and stuff. And then once I got back there, I needed the car, of course. So I think I got a loan from my mom for a couple hundred bucks and had bought a Model B Ford coupe, and that was a pretty good deal, and it was in good condition, and that was about a 1933 model. The Model A was the last year of the Model A was 1931 model. So that, then I had a car, and then I went to the university. And in the university,
So how long did it take you, that whole trip coming back?
I never have calculated the days, but I've got some notes. I think I've got notes.
Were you gone a month? You were gone...
No, I was probably gone about a month. Okay. Total, yeah.
So it took about a month.
Right.
And do you remember about how long did it take to drive up here originally?
It was like 20 days or 21 days, about 3 weeks.
So you lost a week. That's not so bad. Didn't take
maybe.
You...
Maybe. But of course, the bus made better time than we did.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't sure. I'm just estimating. I could check it up.
The way you tell the story, it sounds like it took all summer.
I know. Well, when we left Whitehorse, we were waiting, and we'd check with the RCMP about the road, and they'd say, "Well, they're still working on. They're starting. They should have finished the pilings, and they're starting to lay the planking for the bridge." And so we expect it'll be pretty close. And so we said, "Well, we want to get started." And they said, "We don't advise it because there was still flooding from the breakup and washouts."
Mm-hmm.
And we said, "Well, we want to go." And they said, "There's one place that the road is washing out before the bridge. Now it's flooding, and the culvert is not thawed. And there won't be anybody there right away because they're so busy in other places." So we took off anyway. We figured that we could stop and camp wherever and wait. And what we did, we get this place where, fortunately, it was where the culvert was blocked and road turned, and it was and the water was flowing over this. It wasn't too steep a gradient. So it was nice clear water too from a stream. It was flowing over the road, and so it was about this deep.
Like three feet?
We got out, and we had the hiking boots, but we just waded through there and checked it out. And yeah, it was looked like it was, the part that was washing out was left, the part left was wide enough for the car. So we started driving through, and we only made it just past that one spot, and then it flooded out with the water passing up. We should have taken the fan valve off because it was pumping up and spraying this water, and that probably would have worked if we'd taken the fan valve off or disengaged it. So then we got out, and two of us pushed it, and it's light enough, and we're in water this deep.
Up to your knees.
You could steer it, I'd say, on the side. It wasn't all that hard because it was a very slight gradient. And so we pushed it through and then stopped and opened up the hood and wiped out all the water on everything and the spark plugs and got the engine started again, and then we took off. And then we had to wait at the bridge, for the last two or three planks to be put on. We had to wait an hour or two, which wasn't a big deal. And that was interesting. I think I took a picture in showing this work. And then they got them fixed, and we were, among the first two or three cars going across the bridge. And from then on, that we didn't have any more problems with the road. It was the car and the brakes. So.
And what about flat tires?
Didn't have any.
Oh, that's good.
It had pretty good tires, new tires when I left Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two spares, but we never had to. And part of it was you don't drive too fast on gravel roads.
Right.
And in those days, they didn't use crushed gravel, so they're all mostly rounded, No, they're not as hard as the coarse gravel later on they were putting on there, and they just eat up a tire so fast.
Oh, right. When did you have the option to drive to Skagway and get on a ferry?
No, there was no ferry system then.
Okay.
No ferry system. There were no other options.
Okay.
And the Haines cutoff hadn't been built then. That was a few years later.
Okay.
Or then the Hazleton Highway, you had to go through Dawson Creek. So that there was no other routes.
Okay, so you...
And it was still a ferry on Peace River that you had to take, both going up and going back, because they didn't get around to building a bridge there for a couple of years later. It's a pretty wide crossing, but it's a real big bridge project. But it was a ferry. It was interesting. It was a cable ferry where they used the current.
Right.
Move the ferry back and forth. It could take, you know, 8 or 10, probably 6 cars at a time. Yeah. The mass, most.
Well, it's probably not like there was a huge amount of traffic.
No.
No.
No, there wasn't a huge amount of traffic.
Okay, so you got back to Connecticut and you worked on this dairy farm, and then you started at the university that fall?
I started in that fall, and I was able to...
So this is fall of 47?
Connection with a former elementary school teacher where I went to elementary school in Buckland, that little town. She had roomed with us, and she was always interested in my well-being. And so she knew I was interested in and had experience in farming, and had been interested in farming at one time. And she made the connection with a county agent, agricultural county agent, that lived about 5 miles from the university. And he was renting or leasing a dairy farm. Mm-hmm. But he was working, he had 8-to-5 job. So he had about 4 or 5 milking cows and maybe a total of 10 cows. And he wanted to have someone to live in there, and they would provide room and board with his family. And he would sometimes be available to help getting started in the milking in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then I'd usually have to do the milking at around 5, as soon as I came home from school, and feed and clean up, and washed up the milk. They had a milking machine, and then they provided meals, family style. They had 2 young boys, and mom was a very good cook, and so it was kind of nice. The only problem was that my schedule was, I had to get up really early in the morning, and then I had to go to bed relatively early to get enough sleep, and getting homework done was I ended up doing a lot of homework by between classes at the university. I'd drive there, so there was no, for me, you know, a freshman, there was no socialism. I didn't know anybody else, and I was outsider, which was good. I knew that. I had to do it. And plus, I was mature enough now that I realized I got to study like hell of it. And do well.
So how old were you at this point?
So I'd spent, I graduated, when I graduated from high school, I was 18. I enlisted in the Navy, and I spent a year in the Navy. And then after I get out, I spent a year working for the state forestry department, and just doing woods work. Mm-hmm. And then went to Alaska after that year in the spring again, and spent a year in Alaska. So that's, how many years is that? 18, 19, 19 20, 21.
21.
Yeah, 21.
So you were 21, 22. Well, your birthday's in May.
May.
So I guess, yeah, you're 21.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you were an older freshman.
Oh, yeah, and I had all this experience in Alaska, and I'd attended taking courses at the University of Alaska, which other students didn't know much about, and I had learned so much. I took one of my electives was geology, which I was interested in, and I creamed it because I had seen all these things in Alaska. Mm-hmm. You know, the glaciers and meandering rivers and the dynamics of mountains and stuff. And the professor was a good guy. He questioned me quite a bit about, you sure you don't want to do a geology major?
It didn't work though, huh?
No.
You stuck with wildlife?
I stuck with wildlife, and the professor was a good guy. He had only been there for a short time, but it was in the forestry program. So some of the courses I took were more forestry, which were good, and the people, there was the top-notch forestry people, professors, and he was the only wildlife person. So there were a lot more forestry students than wildlife, but he was a real mentor, and he saw that I had interests and capabilities, so he wanted to know if I wanted to try for an honors program for undergraduate honors, he said you should do this and you can do it. So he said you have to do a research project of some kind, and he suggested a study of a cedar swamp, which was only 4 miles or so from the university. It was a white cedar, and it was an old, historically must have been a lake bed during the post-glacial period, and then because it was poor drainage, and so there was a lot of buildup in the thousands of years, 12,000 years or so since the glaciers receded, there was a lot of peat there. But the cedar, it's sort of like a relic from further north. And so there was snowshoe hares there. Mm. Well, there weren't in other places in Connecticut. There are cottontail rabbits, but not snowshoe hares. And so I did sort of an ecological study, which included snaring some hares. And it was a challenge for me. I used a traditional native method of bending a sapling over, and then making a snare out of wood, and then a hare would go through on a trail, and then it trip this trigger, and it spring up and then choke it.
Oh, it's not the circle kind that they jump through.
They would try to go through it, but the head could go through, and then. If there was brush there, it would just force its way through because there'd be this opening, and it was along the trail. But when they did this, and they triggered this thing to pull it, and it would get them around the neck and choke them. Mm-hmm. And so they would either be dead and hanging there a little bit. It wasn't, at least there, sometimes they'd be hanging if it was a strong enough deal. And it wasn't real cold weather. It was snow on the ground, but if it was real cold, the tree would be frozen and wouldn't pop back up. But, I read all this in Boy Scout manuals and things. So
what was the name of that professor who you was your mentor?
Franklin McCamey.
Do you know how to spell that?
McAIM. McAimey, McAimey.
Okay.
And he was definitely a good mentor and a good advisor. And in that project, I was taking other courses in botany, and I took one course in agronomy, a professor in agronomy. I wasn't all that interested in agronomy, but it was a course that I needed, and I needed some botany courses. I took systematic botany, and I was almost like a minor in botany, and in the forestry, I had courses in tree forest identification. And so this professor in agronomy was a senior professor. He was close to retirement, so he was probably in his 60s. And he was interested in the project I was doing there. And so, I was advised by my wildlife professor to go and talk to him, and I did. And he said, well, what about the history of that cedar swamp? And I had a vague idea about it, but not much, because I hadn't studied that. I was thinking about the living things there. And he said, well, it'd be nice to find out how old that is and how deep the sediments are there. And I said, well, how can I do that? And he said, well, you can probe it. And he said, I could probably get the university machine shop to make a probe that in sections that you screw together. So it was like steel rods that were smaller than your little finger. And so they would be only six feet, and you could have several of those. And he said, yeah, I can get them to do that, and it won't be any cost to you. And we could use them maybe in the future. And so I said, yeah, that sounds good. And he said, yeah, I'd like to go out there with you. He lived on sort of faculty housing with a family, and he had teenage kids. And he said, so on one of the weekends coming up, I said, yeah, that, to do it. And I had my Model B Ford then. And so he said, and that had a rumble seat. So he said, yeah, I'd like to go along and I can. And I said, well, yeah, I'd like your advice as to where to do all this. But I knew the place, I wanted to walk through it, and it was a very strange place. You could easily get lost unless you used a compass. And there were roads all around it, but, there were just little wood roads and occasional house. It's all changed now. But so before that, before that happened, I was out there on a weekend, as was often the case. Instead of going home to visit at home, I was working on this project, or I'd spend, say, Saturday and then go home. Because I lived about 40 miles from the university. So this time I it was a Saturday morning, I went out there and I, by myself, I had hip boots, and because I know I was going through this marshy area, and there were sphagnum ponds, with this really shallow ones, and white spruce. It was really nice, and it was fascinating for me. But you could see it could be kind of airy if you're in there when there wasn't too much sunlight. And so I was walking through there, and I didn't know exactly where I was, but I walked by one of these ponds, and there's a skeleton there.
Oh my goodness!
It's a human skeleton. Yeah. So I looked at, and there's a rope hanging from a leaning tree, a clothesline-like rope that had looked like it had been used to hang oneself, and then it had fallen down and then decomposed. So it was obviously a long time ago. But there was a pair of big old army type hiking boots there, close to a stump. And on the stump was draped a wool coat, a long coat. And so I you know, I and I think I, even then, I could see that there was a little bit of this rope around the vertebrae, but it was laid out straight, so I had a skeleton looking up at you. Yeah. But it was long since the flesh decomposed. Right. And so then I reached in the pockets, and his coat was laid so that it was obviously shedding. It was wool, heavy wool, and there was this letter and glasses in a glass case in the pocket, and this letter. And I opened it up, and it was postmarked, and it was written to this, apparently this guy, about his relatives in Czechoslovakia, and that he was apparently had correspondence said that he was thinking about taking a boat, such and such a boat, to Czechoslovakia or to Europe, and list the name of the boat and date on it. And so I took that letter, put it in my pocket, and maybe I took the glasses too, I don't remember. And so I hiked back out, and I went, drove back to this little road to the highway where there was a restaurant, which where we used to go and students and have, eat a meal there. It was like Italian style food. And so there was a telephone there. So I figured I had to call police and let them know this. So I called up, and it was Saturday, but then it was late morning, and I said, I got hold of a woman who was dispatched, and I said, I found this skeleton in the cedar swamp, and we're doing a study, and she said, oh, yeah, well, why are you calling us? And I said, well, it's a skeleton. It's a human skeleton. Oh, human skeleton? No.
She thought you were telling her about a snowshoe hare skeleton.
And so she said, well, you know, what are the details? And tell me exactly where it was. And I just can't tell her. But I can show, if you send a trooper out, you know, I can show them where it is. Okay, we'll have to do that. But it's formal inspection right at the moment. So they're all in their dress uniforms. I said, well, they should not come in their best clothes because it's rough going. They should have hip boots, and it should be, this sharp brush and stuff. It's not the best to come that way. So she said, okay, she contacted somebody, and she maybe called back and said there'd be a trooper out there just within 45 minutes or something. So I had a little something to eat at the restaurant, and finally a trooper showed up. And said, well, okay, let's go out. And so we started out there, and he said, actually, we had to call a coroner. If it's any, you have to have a coroner. Right. You know, and that they had contacted a coroner, and then they had to call a mortuary to pick this thing up. And so, and I, first this trooper, you know, he thought I didn't know about whether to believe what I'd found, but I had this letter and the glasses, and I, you know, and so then we took off, and I was leading the way with my car, and I go by another professor's house there, who was my comparative anatomy. He was a terrific guy, a fairly young guy, and he was out doing some yard work, and it was just a little gravel road, so it was a nice location for him. It would change later with more houses, but we stopped and told him what we're doing. He said, oh, do you mind if I come along? I said, no. And the trooper said, yeah. And then there was a neighbor to him that wanted to come along too and help, because I said, you can probably use help because we got to get in there, and I'm not, I was afraid I wouldn't be able to find this place. So I had the only thing I had, that was a red bandana. I mm-hmm. ripped it into strips, and I would put it on a branch as I came out, because it's all the same. You could, and I wasn't sure exactly where I was anyway. And so I came out. We all got up there, and the police said, "Well, let's go, but we should have. We really should wait for the coroner." But then he said, "But no telling how long it'll take him to come." And then there will be these people from the mortuary, and they were at some kind of a funeral, so it'll be a while. So let's go. And so here I am. Now I'm leading them back, and I don't really have a good fix on where I'm going. I knew where to start, but once you got in there, and so we'd go a little ways, and I couldn't see the marker, and so I say, keep your eyes on, let's move just so we're still close enough together we don't get lost. And so somebody said, oh yeah, there's a red one over here. So we got over there, and we get this one place, and we had a hard time finding the other one, we're separated, and finally the reason I had gone back there, this is important, the reason I had gone back there on that Saturday, because that I'd been up there one during the weekday in the afternoon, and I had lost my field notebook.
Uh-oh.
With all my data, and I should have recorded all this. So I'd lost that, and so I went back in the hopes of maybe finding it. But I figured that the odds weren't good, but I didn't have any other option. And so when we're going in there, and then we got separated for a little bit, and so, but we're keeping in voice contact, and I said, and we're looking for this red one. And the guy says, oh, I think I found it. I found something. And I thought it was too soon to find the skeleton. And I said, what is it? I'm coming over. And so he came over, and he had my field notebook. And I was so damn lucky. So then we took off. And we found the skeleton, and then the coroner, we heard honking, and so the trooper had to go back, and he was a good soul because he was still in dress uniform, but he did have hip boots, and went back, and then he guided the coroner in, and the coroner was, you know, had a formal suit on and a long coat. It was springtime, but it was, you know, they were still wearing a long overcoat, yeah. And he had just conventional shoes.
Oh, no.
But he was, I mean, he didn't mind getting his feet wet. We got in there, and so I got hip boots, and I'm standing there, and I'm pointing it out, and he's looking at things, and he said, well, take a stick and see what, if there's anything or rope around the neck, and I said, yeah, and I dug out some, and he said, yeah, that's there, so he could conclude pretty fast that this leaning tree, and this guy had committed suicide apparently, and that's about all he... Oh, and he said, yeah, put a stick in the skull and hold it up so we see that it's not got any injury on the skull.
Right.
No, it was all in good shape, and put it back there. And so then he was satisfied, and then we heard honking again, and the undertakers came, two guys. they were game people. They were used to dead people, and one of them was a big, little overweight guy, and the other was a smaller guy, and that was like Mutt and Jeff in size. And they were still had formal clothes that they stripped down and loose, took their ties off, but they left their suit jacket and stuff. And it was, by this time, it's getting nice and warm. And so they came in there, And they had a body bag that zipped, mm-hmm. plastic body bag. It was sort of like this screen, but yeah. the wasn't all that good. And so they figured, you know, just throw everything in there, including the overcoat, and the wet, soggy overcoat, the wet boots, and all these bones, and anything else they found too, like they might have found a watch and maybe a few coins, and so they got all this filled up, and by this time the trooper's gone back, and I said I'd stay there and go out with these undertakers, which I did. They only went just a short distance, and a sharp stick ripped that thing open. All the bones came out. I know, the language was not very good. Threw it in, and then they had the whole list thing walking closer together. Well, it's hard enough. Two guys on this bag with all these bones, and there you have to step on hummocks and things and try to avoid sticks from the dead sticks on the trees. And this broke open about three times. By the time they got out, you know, they just, it was hard to keep all this stuff together. So at any rate, we made it out, and they just departed. And so then, this still isn't the end of the story, because then we get back to this probing, because mm-hmm. that was just after I'd found this, that we worked out this probing deal. So when I went to pick up the professor on the Saturday morning, I guess it was, to do the probing, he said to me, sorry if my daughter and our son and our daughter and a couple of their friends, they were here and they had heard about, they got written up in paper.
Right, the skeleton part.
And so they'd heard about that. They want to go out there and see the spot. And so I said, well, yeah. And they were, you know, energetic young teenagers. And so I had this rumble seat, and we all crowded into my car, holding outside of the passenger side, holding these rods because they were fairly long.
Right.
And we drove out there and went in, and took a while to find that place again. And but before we found it, he told me, after they were getting ready to go, and that they wanted to see the spot. And I said, yeah, well, that's okay with me. So we went out, and we first went to the best location that the professor suggested for probing. And we probed a long way, and we had these rods and got down there about 20 feet or so, and could force it down and screw on another one, and then finally pulled it all back out. So that was worked out well. We got had it worked out as he suggested, and then it was, now can we go to the spot? So we went. It wasn't too far from that, and I found it again. I was getting to know the woods then.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And so we got to the spot, and these kids are down there digging around with sticks. Oh, they got a vertebrae, you know, another one. And, oh, look, this is a few coins.
Yeah.
They found a nickel, dime, a quarter, or something like that, you know. They were so thrilled, and especially the vertebrae,
you got a
human
bone.
Vertebrae. And so they were really happy about the whole experience, and it was a fun time for them and for me, too, yeah. And their dad as well.
Do you remember the name of that professor?
No, I can probably find it. And the other professor, that was a comparative anatomy professor, I did well in that course. I got an A. And the final exam came after this episode. And he said, he told my wildlife professor that that guy has got a wonderful memory because he spent a lot of time in the lab, but there's so much memory involved in this. And he must have been turned on too by the skeleton. And he said, and then he mentioned it to me, and I said, yeah, it's probably true, but I wasn't studying very much, except out there.
Right.
I know where the vertebrae went.
Right. So your study with the snowshoe hares in that swamp, what did you find out?
Oh, just mapping. I mapped. The project was to map the area, the type of vegetation, because it faded out into some just shrubby areas where there were more willows and things, and that's where the hares were, around the edge of the swamp. Not much sign in the swamp. There was not a lot of vegetation because it was, like I said, a dense canopy of the cedar trees. The cedar trees were all about so big.
What is that, 12-inch diameter?
Not quite that big.
10-inch?
These are white cedar, and in New England, they don't grow that big, but they, and it's actually, it's a very valuable wood because it's a cedar, which lasts forever, and so a white cedar, but it's used in cedar chests and things like that. But that swamp hadn't been logged, ever been logged. And I don't know what the status is now, but yeah, and the snow was there, then I could find hare sign very well, and I recorded the birds I saw, the rough grouse and other smaller birds, and fox tracks, and all of that stuff. And I caught a couple of snowshoe hares. I made study skins out of them, which I had learned to do in one class, and gave them to the museum for that college, and that anatomy professor was, when I came to, after I graduated and came to Alaska to do a master's, he said, well, you get it for finding any good bones, you know, from mammals. We don't have much stuff from the West, marine mammals. And one time when I was working in Petersburg, right after I'd graduated probably with a master's here, we came upon a skeleton of a small minke whale, and the skull was been there for a long time. It was sort of a secure place in a bay that people wouldn't see normally, and we were looking for dead deer, I think, and so I saw that skull, and the skull was, it was really nice shape, and I thought, wow, he'd probably like that skull. So we had a big the skull was about from your body to the end.
Is that 5 feet, 4 feet?
4.5, probably. Okay. And like two of us could carry it into and put it in the skiff, and then we took it, we had on a boat that we were sleeping on, and got it back to Petersburg. And I then wrote a letter to put that out in our warehouse, and it was maybe cleaned it a little, not much, and I wrote the professor and said, would you guys, could you use this? We just wrestled the letter back saying, yeah, just send it off, and here's the information, we'll pay for the freight.
Wow.
And so it took a while to build a good crate for it that wouldn't close it up completely, but so it could be handled and shipped, and did that, and they were very happy.
And that was just the skull, though.
Yeah, just the skull.
Yeah.
It was more than, that would have been a big operation to take the whole skeleton.
Yeah.
And they probably didn't have room for a whole skeleton of a Pacific minke whale.
No. So this cedar swamp, is it similar to the Pine Barrens? Is there a connection? No.
It's if you look at a tree, you know, trees of New England or something like that, they'll say, you know, the white cedar is found very spottily in parts of the of New England that haven't been developed too much, and it's usually a very swampy area, but a special kind of swamp. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the kind that would just be cattails and stuff. It had to have a, it probably had been an old lake bed, and then the, and it drained. And so it had good quality soil, mm-hmm. and but it was still sort of a swamp. It was, sometimes if you stepped in one of those holes, a sphagnum, you could hike through there with the bean boots, mm-hmm. if you didn't step in any of those, and you just step around them. And but if you stepped in them, sometimes they would go to your boot, sometimes they would go deep. There were some deeper spots, but not real deep.
So did that, with that probing that you guys did, what did you find out from that?
It was mainly to get an idea on the history, how long, how much sediment there would be there. So it was long. It was a long time. They probably, someone may have followed through and did some peat coring, and then you could do dating. Well, they weren't doing that then, that mm-hmm. time, and that wasn't part of my, this is just a honors thesis. And this was sort of an aside on it, too. I could speculate a little bit based upon what the professor told me, and that was in my write-up. I still have a write-up, a copy of it. It might be in pencil on yellow paper, because I think I had my mother type it up for me, and I wasn't, couldn't type then at all, and she was a good typist.
So what else happened while you were in college?
Well, I was, then I moved in, I think the next year, with a high school buddy from Manchester High, who was, he was a year ahead of me because he started, he didn't go, he went in the military just like I did, and, but he didn't do this adventure to Alaska. Mm-hmm. So he was at least a year ahead. So then I roomed with him, which was a good deal because he was pretty good in math. He was majoring in accounting, and I had problems with some of these physics assignments, and when there were problems to get homework, he was helpful in that. And so, and it was a sort of a new dorm. That was an old dorm, the military Quonsets, and then they built a new dorm. So then I moved into the new dorm the next year, and I went in with another wildlife student who was, I'd made good friends with, and it was a two-person room, mm-hmm. and that was better for me to do that. And then I was supporting myself mainly through summer work, plus had a GI Bill, and at the tuition I didn't have to work full time because of this other jobs that I had. Mm-hmm. It was nip and tuck, but it was cheaper for me too to live there than drive the car back and forth and work. And I couldn't get enough study time when I was mm-hmm. working. It was a terrific deal. I loved that farm work, and I got to learn to use a horse team and haul wood out for their wood furnace in the barn, and haying. That was more in the summertime. I mm-hmm. did that a little bit.
Do you remember the name of that man and that family with that farm?
I probably could pull it out. but I don't think I have it written down either.
Well, when you think about things in the middle of the night, you can think of his name.
But I should say that then the summers, the two summers, what to do in the summer? Well, one thing is to make money, but I'm so spoiled by spending time in Alaska that I just didn't want to take a job. You might find a laborer's job someplace that paid much more than you could for playing. And so I got the idea, why don't I go to northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, and where there's all these wonderful fishing lakes. And I know there were a lot of fishing lodges that were mostly for just families and common people. And so I talked to another close friend from high school who was a student at the university also into going. And so we drove out and I modeled B Ford and to Hayward, Wisconsin. And there there was an employment office, and we said, we want to have this, can we work at one of these lodges? And is there any jobs? Well, they said, yeah, there's two, they weren't in the same place. We couldn't get it at the same place, which, since I had this one car, that was, and these aren't too far apart. Oops. These aren't too far apart. Yeah, they're only like 4 miles or so. And there was both nice fishing lakes and with some lodges on them. And so he got a job at one of them and I another, and I dropped him off there and worked there that summer. Then I enjoyed it so much. It didn't pay a hell of a lot, but and you had to do, they didn't have, they had these cabins that they rented. And they had a central shower and toilets. Mm-hmm. And my job was to clean out the cabins after people left. And then when people were there, I'd wheelbarrow from an ice house where they'd cut ice in the winter and put it in a shed and covered it with sawdust. And I'd go and break up some of those big chunks and put them in the wheelbarrow and put them in their ice chests when people were there, so they would have a cooler so they could keep their food in the cooler. And my job was to be sure I got the ice around there and cleaned up when they weren't there, mopped the floors. They were wood floors, and it's just standard mopping. and then somebody else made up beds and things. I didn't have to do that usually. Occasionally I would, but usually not. And I usually have to swamp out the showers. And then there was, when there was free time, they had me cutting grass around with a scythe around trails between cabins and stuff. And I was under, other than the people that run, the guy that started this family that started it was an old Scottish family from Chicago. And he had run it for a number of years. His wife had died early, I guess. And then his daughter and son-in-law then came and helped them. And then finally he has pretty much turned it over to them. But he was there, and he would do little odd jobs. And he must have been in his 70s then. He seemed pretty old. It was probably in his 70s. And he was just terrific, nice guy. And he was my boss, sort of. And I'd say, now I want you to, you just take the sigh. And have you done any sighing? I said, no, I don't think so. And I'd use a sickle, but... And I'd use an old-fashioned lawnmower, so I had to sigh, I'll show you how. And so this old guy, you know, and he'd show me all of the direct technique. Well, and he'd watch me while I was doing it. Yeah, you're doing it well. Go to it. He'd like to talk to people, and especially because he knew I liked him, because he was the kind of guy that I liked to. And he's so knowledgeable about everything, and you know, he's built this whole thing and cut the ice and for the place, and so sometimes while I was cutting the sai with a sai, he would be standing by me and he would recite Robbie Burns' poetry, which he had by memory. And I could believe that was nice stuff. And when I went back and I checked out Robert Burns' poetry, and wow, that was nice. So I enjoyed that. But in my free time, I had access to the boats and canoes and had fishing tackle, and in the evenings I could paddle out or row out and go fishing for bass. There were some muskellunge there. I never caught any. They were big, giant pike-like fish, and very popular for sport fishermen. But there were a lot of family groups from agricultural area further south that liked to go out and fish for panfish, like walleye, pike, and sunfish, and then they'd fry it up while they were up there. And so it was nice, and I enjoyed it. And then I went back the next year, the same place, whereas the guy that went with me the first time, he didn't go back, partly because we didn't make very much money.
Yeah.
You can make more money. And I had to pay for the, gas going out and back. But I enjoyed it. It was because I could enjoy the country there. And we could afford to go to Tom once and pick him up when we both had evenings off and go to some dance or something. There would be some females that were probably working in these lodges, and we occasionally could line them up and cruise around and have a nice evening together and then drop them off. Having the car was handy for that.
Yeah. Do you remember the name of that place?
I got it written down somewhere. Lost Land Lake, I think, is the name of the lake.
Lost Land.
And Hayward, I think. That's the name of the town in Wisconsin.
Hayward.
Hayward, I think.
Okay.
That's closest town. That was about 10 miles away, I think. And I don't know what it was called.
You don't remember that old...
It might have been Lost Land Lake Lodge. I don't... I might have had it... I wasn't good at keeping a diary, but I might have... I sometimes kept notes of things, but...
And I'm sure you probably don't remember that old guy's name.
I know.
Sounds like quite the character.
He was what my image of a old-timer Scottish origin guy should be. Really nice.
Old tough Scotsman.
Grandfather type guy. Yeah.
Tough guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there was one, interesting, embarrassing situation. He appreciated that there's this young guy in his 20s, and there was women's toilet showers and men's on the opposite side, and there are concrete walks going into them. And he said, I'll do the women's. I know you don't like to do that because you have to put a sign up and you have to make sure there's no women there when you do this. and men's, there was no big deal. You know, I could handle that. Mm-hmm. So then he said, one time, late in the day, he said, Dave, I need you to help me in this women's deal. One of the showers is leaking, and it takes two wrenches, and I need your help on this. And we just, you know, a very considerate guy. You know? And I said, I'll begin to do it. So we, and he'd already, you know, put a bucket out there that when you're cleaning, you just put a bucket out in front and people would know that you're in there.
Right.
And so we went in there and no women, it's quiet time of the day, and it's in the evening. It was just a little after dark, and we're in this shower stall and working on these things and trying to get a pressure on it, and suddenly we hear, tick, 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 someone's in a hurry coming. he looked at me, and she came just barging in there and went to one of the stalls, you know, and you could hear that she was in a hurry. And so I looked at this guy, and I'm starting to panic, you know. And I felt, you know, we should have shouted out, we're in here. And then he goes like this.
Just put his finger.
So let's just be quiet and she'll go away. So I thought, holy mackerel, you know, here and here. And anyway, he said, be quiet. And about that time, he said, is there somebody else in here? He was dumbfounded when she said that. And I grabbed the wrench and I went, bang, bang, yeah, we're fixing the shower.
Oh, she called out. Is there somebody else? Oh.
Yeah, she called out. So she had heard something when she was coming in, but she was in such a hurry she didn't pay attention to it.
Right.
And then she didn't see anybody. She didn't know what was going on. I thought, oh, man, here I'm in there, hiding in the woman's shower.
But it all worked out.
Yeah.
Well,
I think he was, of course, he would have been somewhat embarrassed himself, but he thought he could, just by being quiet, maybe we could sneak out of it. And I figured that's too much. Risk is too high.
Yeah, I figured by just being quiet and she'd do her business and leave, and she never would have seen you or known you were there.
Well, but she might have figured and looked in the shower, and there's these two guys crouching down in there.
Yeah, and you didn't mean to scare her, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, hopefully it didn't faze her.
Oh, I'm sure it didn't.
Everybody was camping.
Oh, there was one time when we were coming back to Alaska on a Greyhound bus down through the South, and this was a first time I had this experience that, you know, they pull into a pit stop and the driver would say, we're going to be here for 10 minutes. The toilets are in and to the right or something like that. And so it had been a fairly long stretch, and I don't know whether I was sitting with another guy or not, but there weren't a lot of people on the bus, like about six or eight, and it was at night, and probably in the wee hours, that's why there weren't many people. And so I got off and walked into the men's toilet and was standing by this urinal. And this other guy was right beside me. And there was this woman that was in the back of the bus, and she was in a hurry. And she came rushing in, and she didn't see that it was men's. That's the guy rushing in and goes right into what DOC didn't see the urinals or anything. And then she may have heard us talking. And she said, "Are there men in here?" And one of us said, "Yes, this is a men's toilet." Oh, he was scuffled around and went out and went back. And I thought, we really missed a bit there. We should have said, "Oh, no, ma'am, this is the black man's toilet," because they were...
Back then, they were separate.
They were separate, yeah. But she wouldn't appreciate that humor.
No. That would, if you'd been able to think that quickly, that would have been pretty good.
Yeah, right.
I was going to ask you, though, you mentioned living with, having roommates, if you remember their names, the guys you lived with the first year, your friend from high school.
Randall Toop. This is a guy I visited this last October.
Oh, you're
October.
Still, yeah. How do you spell Toop?
T-O-O-P.
Okay.
Randall Toop.
And then the other guy who was the wildlife student?
Ted Bampton. B-A-M-Bampton.
T-O-N?
P-T-O-N. He was, I think, Italian heritage, and he became director for game management for the state of Connecticut.
Oh.
And then he died of a heart attack when he was only in his mid-40s.
That's too bad.
It was. He was certainly good health when he was a student.
Yeah. Well, so you did those two summers at the lake in Wisconsin, and then what did you do for summer employment in college?
That was in college,
your Wisconsin Lake summer jobs, right?
Well, I was an undergraduate student at the University of Connecticut, right.
So that's two summers, and you're usually in college for 4 years.
No, I was only there. I had some credits from the University of Alaska. I'd say I was only 3.5 years at the University of Connecticut because I was able to take a full, maximum. They would allow me 18 credits, I think, and I got a couple of credits, and you had to have physical education, and they automatically gave you credits for that for military service.
Oh.
So, it didn't take me long, and I didn't want it to take me long. The sooner the better I got through that, because I had my heart set on coming back to Alaska, and I knew what I wanted to do.
Okay, so you're 3.5 years at University of Connecticut, and then you graduated in what year?
51.
Okay.
And that's when for that summer, I came here and worked on the Kenai Moose Range. So I had been accepted into the graduate program through the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit, and the head of the unit, Neil Hosley, who later became first dean of the university, he lined up this job for me on the Kenai Moose Range. So I had, and they wanted me up there almost, they were unhappy because I didn't stay for commencement, I just finished courses and final exams and left. Because I had to fly back in order to get, so then I borrowed some money from my mom to pay for the flight back to Anchorage. And then the refuge manager, there was no road to the Kenai. And so he flew up in their Fish and Wildlife plane and picked me up. I had a couple of nights in Anchorage, which wasn't the greatest. Anchorage was, I didn't have much money. I spent all my money on the airline ticket, and I found the cheapest place in Anchorage, which was place where there's double bunks, and it was like $1.50 a night or something like that. And I didn't have direct contact with the refuge manager because he's a pilot and he was flying all over the state. And he was out, I think, out in the Yukon Customs Delta. And so I had to wait an extra day there in Anchorage, and finally showed up and flew me down. And then I began working there.
And was that Dave Spencer was the refuge manager?
That was Dave Spencer, yeah.
Okay. So what did he have you do there?
Well, you should put there, indicate that that at that stage there was, he was the refuge manager. The only other full-time employee was a maintenance man that kept vehicles going and anything that had to do with that. And his wife was, they didn't have money to hire as a secretary. She was well qualified, so she volunteered.
That's Dave's wife.
Yeah.
What was her name?
Paige.
No, Paige is their daughter.
Oh, is that right?
Well, unless she's named after her mother.
No, that's you're right. I'll think of her name. But and she wasn't there a lot because he was flying so much. And so neither she nor he were there a lot of the time because he was staying with friends in Anchorage, I think. And they had just sort of moved in and to this house that needed renovation. The bathroom didn't work and the plumbing was being fixed. So it wasn't a very convenient place for them. And I stayed in the bunkhouse, which was just a little bit of a room on the in this big barn that was a sort of warehouse. All of this, most of this stuff had been military during the war. And so it was really close to the Kenai Airport, which was an important airport during the war.
Oh.
It's an emergency airport alternative to Anchorage. And that's probably one reason why they had the headquarters there then. They moved it to near Soldotna later on, because it was more into the refuge. But at any rate,
so
what he did, what he asked me to do is, he said, one thing we need to do is, this is this brand new refuge, and there's no road to Anchorage. There's railroad to Seward that stops at Moose Pass, and then there was a road from Kenai to Moose Pass, a gravel road. And I don't think there was a road to Seward then. From there, the train went to Seward. And so then the road went by, have you been down the Kenai?
Mm-hmm.
Skelak Lake, you know?
Where? Yep.
So the road went by Skelak Lake, the old road.
Right.
And so he wanted to build the first campsite and camping site that was road accessible on Skelak Lake. And they had when they built the road into the lake, they just a bulldozer, and then they didn't cut anything. You know, in those days, they just pushed the trees into a big pile and piles. And so he said he and I would be working together when he was around. And he took me up there and showed what he was doing, but he couldn't stay around very long, and had a tent, and he rigged me up with a tent and some kind of a Coleman stove, I guess, and a boat with an outboard, a skiff with about a 15 horsepower motor. And he said, so I want you to start working with a handsaw, a sweet saw, and an axe, and since I'd had lots of woodwork, he knew that. I knew how to do these things. And he was competent. And so he sort of showed where we probably could work here and cut up these burn piles and make places for tents, but try to do it nicely so that you leave a few trees and stuff. And I said, I can certainly do that, but I could see that there was so much this stuff to work with that it was going to take a long time. But you got to start. And so he said when he has the time, but obviously he was flying around doing wildlife work, especially a lot of waterfowl work in Yukon, Kuskokwim Delta, Nunavak Island, and Alaska Peninsula, and all over the state, because he had this widgeon, a twin engine. Mm-hmm. You know the widgeon?
I've heard of it. I don't know airplanes.
It's like a small Grumman goose. Mm-hmm. You know the Grumman goose?
Yeah.
Big one. This looks like one from a distance until it gets up close, and it's just smaller, but it can carry, you know, without any baggage, maybe 8 or 9 people, and plus the pilot and the co-pilot. And so,
So if he was the Kenai Refuge manager, why was he flying all over the state?
Because they didn't have pilots, enough pilots to do this. I mean, the aircraft division in Anchorage was just getting started. It was obvious that airplanes, they had to have airplanes and they had to have pilots. And like former Governor Hammond, mm-hmm. was been a pilot in the war, and he was worked as a pilot for Fish and Wildlife and did a lot of things, but mostly he was involved in some of the wolf control work. Hmm. Have you read that?
I haven't read his book, no.
Hammond's, it's good. He's got pictures of him when he's by his plane with wolves that he killed. He says this is something that he... It's difficult for him to live with now when he's governor.
Yeah. So Dave was flying around and doing wildlife work around the state.
Yeah, and he would, and included waterfowl work, included mountain sheep surveys. And so when, on the Kenai, when he was doing the mountain sheep surveys, he took me along as an observer. Well, that was nirvana because I was interested in that's mountain ungulates. And we did some, I was already, the one of the Fish and Wildlife people based at that time in Anchorage, I think, was Robert Scott. He was a biologist, one of the first biologists hired post-war. He had a master's from Oregon State. And he was later became an important mentor for me. And so I was assigned, they would work it out with the sheep biologist, Scott, with Dave Spencer, that Scott had started some sheep studies in the mountains where he was well-trained and was interested in habitat, and though we actually built some rustic enclosures in some areas that were heavily used by the sheep. He built with help from Spencer, built a little tent cabin with a wood frame, mm-hmm. and a wood stove up there in the sheep country. And one of the things I had to do was to do some of the sheep surveys in the plane with Dave Spencer. And then later I had to spend about 10 days up there with the sheep. And so he flew me into a small lake near Custamina Lake, mm-hmm. the headwaters near the head of the lake. It was up about another 1,000 feet. And then from there, we could land with the widgeon, and then I could hike up from there to this hut, which was up in the alpine areas. Mm-hmm. And that was nirvana for me. I mean, and so I was following up on some of the work that God had done, and mainly they wanted me to do, after lambing, to do race counts of lamps to use, and he was doing that. And I ended up later on going all over the state and doing this one. I was the next summer when I was a student here. Then I was doing these seep surveys, which was just, I never expected that I would be so lucky to be up in the White Mountains. And we didn't go into the Brooks Range, but White Mountains, the Chugach Mountains, the Talkeetna Mountains, the Kenai Mountains, and the Alaska Range Mountains. I'd spend 4 or 5 days in each one. They'd drop me off, and it was mostly, a lot of them, I was by myself. Occasionally, there would be somebody else with me. That was nirvana. And so for the boat and motor that he left there at the camp place.
At Skelack Lake.
At Skelack Lake, he said, you can use this to go around the lake or to get across the lake, and I want you to start a collection, plant collection for an herbarium. They should have an herbarium. And they knew my CV said I'd taken systematic botany and knew plants pretty well. And this was just, and he says, just when you do that, when the weather's safe to go out on the water. And then when it's not safe, then work on the campsite. So it was a higher priority to collect plants. That was very fascinating for me, especially if I could go directly across the lake. There was a trail that he told me about that was used for the old timers when there were guided hunts for mountain sheep or grizzly bears with horses. Mm-hmm. And I could hike up there into the alpine and collect plants, and oh man, it was terrific. See the sheep and what.
Did you interact with the Anderson family?
On
Skelack Lake? They had a homestead on an island there?
Panhandle Island, yep. Yep, I did. And that was a very momentous occasion for me because his wife had died some years ago. He was in his 70s then. Mm-hmm. He had remarried a young woman who was apparently thought she liked that kind of lifestyle. And I think it lasted for a while. But I think he was hanging on when they were living in Seward. And he just had such wonderful years out there. And he was a guide, had horses. And
yeah, that's why I asked about it. He'd been a guide.
Yeah. But he had, when I went out and visited him, I mean, they welcomed me and he showed me around. And it's just amazing what they did. He and his wife, she had beautiful gardens, and some of them were wildflower gardens. And she even collected seeds and would sell them. Put them in packets and sell them in Seward. And, things like lupin and fireweed and things. And they had a big windmill that was used to had about three cross-cut saws, like, in a line. And then the windmill turned this gear that made these things go up and down. And then it also had a deal that would gradually push the logs through. So once you put the logs in place, you'd be there and make sure everything's going right. But you only could do this when the wind was blowing.
So it was a sawmill that was powered by a windmill? A sawmill to cut logs?
Yep, that's what it was for.
Huh.
But he also had some small windmills on top of his workshop that he could run a drill press. With a small windmill, just with belts and what.
Wow.
But, of course, you can only do it when the wind is blowing. And the wind blows like hell occasionally there, and it's unsafe to be out on the water because it comes off the glacier at the head and comes down. And it's a very dangerous lake, and a lot of people lost lives or got into real trouble there because they'd be out and wind came up before they could get ashore. But it was probably... you waited too long when it was good fishing or something and didn't get to shore in time.
But so he had that wind, enough wind to power those things. Did he use it for electricity?
No. That's why he had the power drill and thing. They didn't use it for electricity because it wasn't steady enough to do that, and they weren't into that at the time. If there had been a stream on shore and they were on shore, they probably would have had a hydro. He was a good guy, and he was a good engineer and designs and stuff. And they had a nice garden. They had all kinds of, the chickens. I'll tell you about the chickens. they wanted to have chickens. Well, how do you get started with chickens out in a place like that? Well, they would have, if you went to Seward, you could buy eggs that are shipped up. In the lake, there were two rocky islands that had cormorants nesting on them, which I banded some of the young when I was there. But the cormorants, these nests were right there. You could pull up boat, and there was nothing on them except cormorants and nests and a lot of cormorant droppings. And there would be, like, on one island, there'd be 40 or so cormorants, maybe 20 nests or something on one island. So they got this idea. Well, they knew that cormorants had a long incubation period. If we could get some eggs that were fertile eggs and put them there, the cormorants could incubate them. So had gone to Seward with a boat and it's long operation, lining up the Kenai River and through Kenai Lake and then a short road, buggy road from one end of Kenai Lake to Seward of 15 miles or so. So they'd go there and the eggs would come up from Washington or Oregon and cold storage. And they just assumed that most people that raise chickens would have, in the old way, you had roosters and you ate some of them and you had produced eggs. And so they took a couple dozen eggs back with them, and they put these eggs in the cormorant nests. Now, I think they might have, seemed to me I don't know how many eggs cormorants have, but I think they had maybe three, something. They usually take one or two out, and so they'd put the chicken egg, and they were pretty close to the same size, and they put them around there. And then they went back to their homestead, and they figured 20 days, it's 21-day incubation for chickens. They went back with a big boat that's one of old outboard on, and they had one of these big galvanized wash tubs, and they put shavings in the bottom, and they put a lantern, and they had a kind of a wood cover on it, or maybe canvas. And so they went out there, picked up these eggs, and put them in this shavings and stuff, and with the lantern to maintain the heat while they're out there. And they went back to the island and took them out and kept the heat in there, and they started hatching. The next day, they got, I think, 80% hatch.
Wow, 80%.
It was amazing. He said, they couldn't believe that they didn't know it was going to work at all. They didn't know that they were fertile eggs, but they thought there was a good chance they would be, because in those days, you get eggs, and they were usually fertile eggs, and they wouldn't start incubating or growing as long as they're in cool storage.
That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. But they were so innovative like that.
Yeah.
And they had goats, yeah. a few goats. And then they had they loved the moose, you know, and wanted to be sure they, sometimes the moose would come out in the wintertime out to the island and browse around the island and walk on the ice.
So the lake froze over in the winter?
Oh, yeah. And so they, and the wool, the, and the sun, and the cows sometimes would come out there and to have their calves mm-hmm. to get away from the bears and possibly wolves. So one winter when the lake was freezing up, the moose, probably the moose population was pretty high then, and that kind of over-browsed on the mainland, but there's, it was more browse out on the island. Some moose, I forget what he said, two or three moose walked out there on the ice, and it was clear ice, and they slipped and fell. They couldn't get up. So there's, because it was so slippery.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they do? They cut willow boughs, brought it out there, laid it down in front of the moose. And then they were able to work and with a wagon, a full wagon and a wheel, like a big wheelbarrow with bicycle wheels or something. And they dug out sand and, of course, gravel that was in a place on the island, and they started spreading this all the way out. I think they were closer to the mainland, the moose, so they worked from the mainland, from the moose to the mainland, mm-hmm. and laid this stuff. And I think they started from the mainland because they didn't want the moose to get up and fall on this ice. And then they spread this stuff around so moose could get up. And then they, when they finished it up, they went back to their island the next morning. The moose had gone back to the mainland.
Hmm.
It was amazing.
So the moose hadn't fallen in. They just were on top. Wow. And I can't remember his first name, Mr. Anderson.
I can't remember it either. I might have it.
But his, the reason...
Might be something like Andy.
No, it was... His son is Val.
Uh-huh.
I interviewed him. That's why I...
Oh, is that right?
Know the story. I don't know if he was around anymore by the time...
I don't know. I never met anybody.
Yeah. So that's why I knew about the family. What was the name of the island you said again?
I think it's Frying Pan Island. That's it. Frying Pan Island.
Yeah,
Shaped like a frying pan.
Yeah. I thought it was a very interesting... story to hear about when I interviewed Val.
Hey, no, if you want another story about when I was out there, they've said there's another guy, an old timer, a trapper and prospector at the east end of the lake, and a cabin out in the woods. And he said he had stopped by and one time in earlier in the summer before I got there and talked to him. And he was a really nice, friendly guy and said, you know what, if you over around this area, I'm not going to be here this summer. And I'm going back to Seward and doing other things or something. The cabin will be there and just help yourself, you know. And so he said, but, you know, there's bears, a lot of bears around, grizzlies around his cabin because it was close, not too far from the salmon stream. And he said, he told Dave that he had to, when he goes out, if he washes up in the morning, he has this wash basin He usually just opens the door and walks out and throws the water out. But he says, "Hey, have to look closely, or there might be a bear right there." But he said, "Bears," and he gets along fine. So then so Dave's told me, "You know, if you're up there, he may still be there, and but you can probably stay there if you want." And I wanted to hike up in those mountains behind that because mm-hmm. there are a lot of sheep there, and it was. I wanted to do more plant collecting. So I went up there one day and motored up and pulled up, and he was still there. And he said, you know, he said, "Oh, yeah, Dave said you might be here." And he was, and he wanted to know, you know, what I was doing and all the thing. And, that's you can use the cabin, but I'm leaving today. The plane's going to come in and pick me up from Seward. And I'm leaving, but just you're welcome to use the cabin. I said I did have this bear hanging around here, but it shouldn't be a problem for you. So I stayed there that night. And so the bunk I was sleeping in was pretty narrow. It was right close to this window. It was like a window this big, and it was just solid pane.
Like a 2 foot, like a ship's window, like
fixed window.
Yeah, it was fixed. Like a ship, like a porthole. No,
it was square.
Square, like
a rectangular, but it was a fixed. It wasn't openable right. window. There were another openable window somewhere. I was all filled with these stories about bears, and I'm sleeping. Suddenly, I hear. I don't know why I was sleeping, or maybe I hadn't gone to sleep, but it's dark, and I'd had a candle or something, and I did have a flashlight, which I took and set by the bed there, by the bunk, and I heard this horrible noise. It was like, you know, put your fingers on the chalkboard.
Oh,
it was right there close to me, and I realized, it was right there on the window outside.
Ooh.
Ah. But it was just sort of, and then, so I felt around for the flashlight. And I turned it on, and here's this face of a porcupine.
Oh.
And it's trying to climb up, and it's just slipping on the glass. I was saying, I was trying to imagine what a bear doing something like that, but I didn't see him right for a bear, but it was such a weird noise.
Well, you would think it was a bear trying to get in, I think. So did you ever run into that bear?
No, I ran into one or two bears, but I never ran into that particular one. And my experience with bears down there was that they always, when I was up in the Alpine or something, if they saw you, they ran away before you got close.
So when you were working on that campground, though, at Ski Lack Lake, you didn't have bears around?
It would have been mostly black bears there, probably, but they could have been either. But no, I think probably Dave might have told me to put the food in a separate place or something like that, not in the tent.
Do you think there were fewer bears then? Because nowadays that Kenai Peninsula has so many bears, it seems.
But there are more blacks and reds than brown bears now. But the brown bears had increased because it was considered sort of a threatened population because it's isolated from other bears. It's all down around the Kenai River
mm-hmm.
and near Soldotna. And they had major problems here 5 to 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then they finally shaped up and stopped selling building lots right along the river, which was stupid anyway. And they cleared, and they had to buy out some people because it just, you couldn't have bears and salmon and fishermen without and have people living where you get food and everything. It didn't make sense that they took a big joint effort. That was one time when the refuge state fish and game, so feds and them, and they worked with the schools and they educated people mainly through the schools. That was Audubon and Nature Conservancy, and they hired people to work through the schools and give talks in the schools, and the whole community finally realized, yeah, this is such a terrific resource here, and it isn't just like, you know, we're in Alaska, we should be able to build property or have our own private property right wherever we want, you know, right next to the richest salmon river in the state. I mean,
yeah, but there's still a lot of recreational sport fishing on those rivers down there.
Kenai is, if it's been up to date now, I've just been up to date on it because I have an interest in the area, and the big problems, and the big problem is that sport fishing has increased, and the sport and subsistence fishing take priority over commercial fishing. So commercial fishing includes charter fishing.
Uh-huh.
Too many big boats with big outboards and fishing for king salmon on that area, on the river. But there's also a big run of cohos.
Yeah, but I think with all those people down there and all those bears down there, that would be a conflict.
Oh, there is conflict. But conflict is more between, the conflict is between sport fishing and to some extent between commercial sport fishing, guided and charter fishing, but also then on the beach right at the mouth of the Kenai River, there's the drift net fishing.
Right.
Or is it beach?
Set net?
Yeah, they set at low tide.
Yeah.
And then tide comes in when the salmon are coming. It's mostly not the king salmon that they're taking, it's mostly the cohos.
Yeah.
And some pink. And so then now there's lawsuits claiming that that they unfairly are shutting down the commercial fishing, and those commercial fishing people are saying, well, it's subsistence fishing too, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But the problem is getting very complex. And then there's drift netting is allowed too. And they wait for the tide, and then they set these in the, when the fish are moving into the river.
Right.
Before they come in the river. They can't go into the river before they come in the river. Now some breakthrough is one of those guys that was fishing that way and wanting to figure out some solutions. They were catching too many king salmon.
Yeah.
And that even though they were trying to use a net size, that the king salmon were too big, but they'd get tangled up and they'd basically be dead and they couldn't keep them. And they wouldn't survive if they just threw them back in. And so, of course, the sport fishermen were mostly after the king salmon, and they were up in arms about this.
Yeah.
Well, this guy had done some experimental using shallower nets that don't go as deep, and found that the king salmon are deeper, and that when he fished up higher, he was catching just target species of cohos.
That's cool.
And that last I heard, Fish and Game said, well, this may be a partial solution, and we'd have to require the nets be
right.
Shorter, and so they won't be catching them. And seemed like, well, then commercial fishermen said, well, we could probably live with that. But then they had this problem do when they were catching so many when they're running. It's just, you know, the tide goes out and there's all of these fish and they're butchering them, and they not, what do they do with the guts? They just leave them there.
Right.
And the tide comes in and it's normal and the go back to the sea to some certain extent, but there was so much that then DEC was there and tested the water, and the bacteria count was excessive. And right. So they had to shut down the fishery. And that partly was these people were, they sort of thought that there was a limit to all of this stuff and either have to pay someone to take this stuff away and treat it as a sewage or something, or recycle it or compost it or what have you, instead of letting it there where it could happen. This was this summer.
Yeah, but so when you were down there at Skelak Lake, you said there were not so many grizzly bears, more black bears?
Generally, the grizzly bears were in the mountains and would come down along the streams close to the mountains, the salmon streams. Mm-hmm. And when they got further away, it's variable, though, because most of the bears were concentrated, the grizzly bears were concentrated around the Kenai River and the Tustamina River. The black bears don't get along well. The grizzlies, it's too dangerous for them. But the black bears are scattered out, and their diet is more cosmopolitan. Mm-hmm. So they get what they can. And if there's salmon, yeah, but they're not going to be too competitive. But the black bears are major predators on moose calves.
Oh.
So that's where moose, and out in the flats where there's a lot of lakes and what, the cow moose often go to islands to have their calves. And black bears sometimes go there but they have to swim to get there. And so it's safer for them where they're around the edges of the lake and moving around. But they're opportunistic, you know. They will take the calves if they're around, or try to. And a cow sometimes can defend the calf by just standing its ground. If it's a small black bear, they are usually successful keeping the bear around because they get in close, you know, they rear up. You know,
they'll kick them.
With their front feet, and they're just like pile drivers. So you can break the skull of a bear.
Wow.
And the big black bears are usually tougher and are persistent and sometimes can get them.
Hmm. So you're calling it the Kenai Refuge. At the time you started, 1951, was it still the Moose Range?
It was still the Moose Range when I started. I forget when it was changed the name to the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, right?
And you were there just that one summer before you started here as a graduate student.
When I was a professor, I used to take classes down there, and we would get a tour of the refuge, and so I kept in touch with the refuge managers and knew them well and had known most of them before as well.
So most of the time you were there, it sounds like you were by yourself. You were out at Skelak Lake or up in the mountains?
The one time another student was doing a special study on mountain sheep under the same mentor, Bob Scott, a later summer. I went down to do the counts. I was doing the counts in the lamb ewe counts on the Chugach Mountains out of Anchorage. And then they wanted me to go down there and go out with this other student who was going to take over this, because I was studying my master's on mountain goats. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't have the time to do all these. And so that was Jack Gross, G-R-O-S-S. He was, he went on to do, he was strong on statistics, and he did a PhD someplace in Colorado, I think. And he was, I didn't get along too well with him. He was kind of know-it-all kind of guy. He was really sharp, but, and he's, you know, been there, done that, you know, in mm-hmm. terms of, he was a super outdoors person, et cetera, et cetera. And then he went into the White Mountains where I'd, under instructions from my mentor there, I was again, because of my botanical orientation, I was collecting plants and doing transects and describing the vegetation, and I had a tape, and I'd build a small cairn mm-hmm. and of rocks, and to mark these, and these were to be prominent, and I'd map them and give the locations approximately. We didn't have GPS with compass bearings on other things, to be checked in the future. And Jack Gross, when he got assigned to do this, and I wasn't involved, he knew that I was doing these studies, but he didn't know about the cairns. And so he was there, and he said he felt like he was in a real wilderness area, and then he saw this goddamn cairn someone had built. So he tore them down. He wanted to be natural, wild area. And he didn't have much experience. I hadn't read much about cairns in the Arctic, where, you're expected to build cairns because you might not make it, and you leave notes and information in there for other people.
Yeah, they're sort of trail markers.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so what I want to tie up the Skilak Lake part, and the next time we'll start after that, winding down here.
Right.
But, so can you kind of think about what that experience that summer meant to you?
Okay, but there's one thing that I did do down there, which was not by myself. There was this whole concept of managing moose habitat there at that time. The moose habitat was generated by the extensive fires. And so what happens when some of these areas were not good habitat or had been, and they're growing up to spruce now, and then the concept of controlled burns. Hmm. So then that was with Dave Spencer with the refuge, and working in conjunction with the BLM. I forget the name of the guy. I think his last name was also Scott, but he was a different Scott. And they were planned to do a controlled burn, experimental. So it was up in sort of upland area a bit near, in the hills near Kisilov. Mm-hmm. And near the Kisilov Lake. No, Tustamina Lake, it's, which was near Kisilov. But it was near Tustamina Lake, but it was up above the lake quite a bit. But it was a shrub tundra kind of situation. And the shrubs were dwarf birch, which isn't good for moose boughs. And there were some few scattered small trees, and so there was a team put together, including Dave and me from the refuge, and maybe the maintenance guy, all the people they could gather, and plus BLM, and we were moved out there, and we had stayed in tent camps. We built a fire line, and then we and there was probably some natural line, maybe a edge of a small lake that we did, was, and we, you know, were waiting for the weather, proper weather. Well, if it was too dry or windy, they couldn't, it was too great a risk, they couldn't do it. If it was too wet, it wouldn't burn. So, finding the, we were out there for about 4 days, I think. And we finally, we started when we thought it wasn't quite as dry as we wanted, but at least it was safe to try it. And we had, you know, these tanks, and you could start flamethrower
things.
And walking along, starting these fires, and it would, it'd come, especially where we were piled up some stuff, there was more fuel there, and it would get started, but they wouldn't carry, wouldn't go. And we made a big effort, you know, and we thought it was going to go, so we were super careful and had all the standby, and we couldn't get it to go. And then, then it rained a little bit, and I couldn't do this. And so then the weather turned dry again, and we tried it once more time, but we couldn't get it to burn safely. And that was a sort of a failed because we couldn't really test it. And the outcome was basically it's almost always going to have an unfavorable wind when it's dry enough to burn. And plus, they didn't want to risk it if it was super dry, because what happens if a big thundercloud comes up, then you get wind generated and maybe out of control.
Well, they do. They have had big wildfires out there.
Oh, yeah.
Since
there's been wildfires since this was this. There were some areas. The refuge has they've tried all techniques. You know, before while it was still a moose range, got somewhat controversial. They got, I think, because of the fires, extensive fires, it wasn't always where they wanted them.
Right.
And there was some of these old burns that had patches of cottonwood or aspen that didn't burn, but the aspen didn't seed in well, and that's good moose browse, young aspen, and they weren't getting. Oh, and some, you know, that area also the that had come back after a fire. That's right, and so the spruce trees were like 8 or 10 feet high, and of course the moose weren't eating those, and gradually it's. There wasn't any significant browse in the too many spruce trees, and we got to get, how do we get rid of this? And so I think they got a lot of money, BLM got a lot of money, or not BLM, the refuge got a lot of money, but maybe it was BLM too, to improve. It was a result of, it was fire, and it intended fire money, but I think they were able to get it for moose habitat improvement on the Kenai.
Yeah, so the idea is you create better browse habitat, so you'll get more moose.
So they bought specially designed huge, giant machines that have big wheels and heavy and cleats on them, and that could just mow down the forest and crush it up. So they didn't.
Didn't have to burn it.
You broke it into a spruce log would be broken up into chunks, this big,
like 3 feet chunks.
So this they didn't have to burn, and they created some disturbance on the land. But you had to do this at certain times of year because it had to be in the early. It had to be in the winter when there wasn't too much snow, mm-hmm. because they couldn't operate it too much snow. But because they were so heavy, if they get the ground had to be frozen, and sometimes they got them stuck, and they had, you know, to get them out, it took 2 or 3 bulldozers with chains and stuff.
So is the purpose of the moose range was to keep increasing the local moose population? So that's why they had to manage so intensively?
Yep. But that's where the controversy started coming in. It was mainly environmental groups in Anchorage that were, by this time the road was built and people were appreciating it's a great, the refuge was a great place. And what this thing really is part of the National Wildlife Refuge System. And what is the reason for them? For protecting natural habitat and moose, or not moose, and wildlife of some kind, waterfowl and the whole works. Well, this moose range was under the same logic. I mean, there's a lot of waterfowl areas and we're managing for those, but it appeared like, and then it was, you know, they were mowing down, they wanted to mow down the snags after a fire. Mm-hmm. So it looked nice.
But that's habitat for birds or something,
especially
right?
Woodpeckers. Uh-huh. And so that's when environmental groups said, hey, what's going on? They're decreasing the biodiversity by this, and it's all for one species. This is not what refuges should be. Well, I think there was such a strong movement that the name, that led to changing the name to National Wildlife Refuge. And then that also came down that we should manage for all the species let's get do some inventories. What species do we have? But small mammals and birds, rather than just producing more moose. And that's part of the problem now on the State Board of Game on the Kenai. They won't. They want to do wolf control.
Yeah.
And the local fish and game biologist there, who was one of my students who worked on deer project on Kodiak that was habitat study, he told them, Board of Game, they said, no, that's we should have, we have endless moose seasons here because there's too many overwintering moose and the habitat can't, they're knocking down the willows. There's virtually no willows because of continual heavy grazing. And the birches sometimes go on growing, but they can't get higher than this and they get hedged. Mm. And you have birch trunk this big that's my 50 years old and it's still...
They get stunted.
Yeah. Mm. So at any rate, I'm going to talk about a little bit about this at this meeting in Alyeska.
Yeah, well, that's good. So, I mean, that summer sounds like just an amazing experience for a young guy interested in wildlife and biology.
It's unbelievable. I mean, when I came from the University of Connecticut, I thought, I'm so damn lucky to be admitted into the graduate school, and I still didn't know what I'd be doing. And it was just, it couldn't have been a better place for me to spend the summer. And Spencer, he's a guy I had a tremendous respect for. He wanted to know if I wanted to go moose hunting with him. He says, you can get the carry. And I said, yeah, and we got a moose. And he went in the field with me a couple of times when I was starting to goat study, and knew how to live in the mountains. I didn't have much experience about that, proper climbing stuff. He was just top notch. And then at the end of that first summer, here I'd been doing all these things on my own, got a good start in the plant collecting, and I'd asked him about banning the cormorants, the young cormorants, and he was banning waterfowl out in the Yukon Delta, working with those. Yeah, he had the right size and gave me the equipment and told me how to put them on and said, go for it. And I did that. And then it come the end of the summer, he's busier than hell flying. And so he's gone. He said, I got this narrative report. We have to do it every year. And it's due in short time. He said, I want you to start doing it. Start the report. I thought, me? I was a temporary, summer temporary? And I wasn't told I was going to do anything like this, and I don't have that kind of experience or ability. I don't know how to do this. He said, look at the previous reports, there's some photographs and stuff, go ahead and start it. I can't do it, and that's you're going to have to start that. So, and I never thought of myself at that stage being a very good writer. I was a poor speller always. Didn't have any spell check. And I, was penciled in a line pad like right. that. And so I started, and he was long gone, and I was there by myself. And he said his wife would be back, and he could type it out. And so I roughed the whole thing out, and I don't know whether he looked it over before she typed it out or after, but it's probably before. But he went over and he says, oh, looks like it's a good job. Let's get it typed up and we can do more editing. Yeah, and so I wrote the whole report, and I never thought I'd be capable of doing this. Well, that's how you have abilities, but you get to have to be pushed a little and mm-hmm. bring them out. And I look at the report now. If I look at it, as I read it in the library there by my office, it's not a bad report.
For your first time, yeah.
Right.
Well, I think, too, that how you had the courage or the bravery, whatever, to be out there by yourself and doing all this, new things you hadn't necessarily done before in terms of the being in the outdoors part.
But I had enough training in biology and wildlife ecology and I was sharp enough to know that I could figure things out by myself, but I felt I was insecure and I lacked confidence, self-confidence, because mm-hmm. I was still, I figured they don't kind of hire permanent people unless they've got a master's degree in biology positions, and I was just getting started, and that's just Alaska. Well, that's one of the good things about Alaska. I mean, I wouldn't have got that kind of experience if I'd gone into, say, maybe Montana or the West or certainly the Midwest. I would have been interesting work and I would have enjoyed it, but it'd been under closer supervision and less responsibility. I mean, it's responsibility. Giving someone responsibility, then you try harder and you want to do it right. And I look back sometimes and I'm just amazed that I was so fortunate to. And that Kenai, especially the Kenai, because since then I've been, kept keeping up on the Kenai because I have students working on projects down there that I couldn't have recommended they do. Mountain sheep and other projects, and then now with the Nature Conservancy, there was a lot of. I've been on the board for quite a while, and there was a lot of focus on the Kenai and among the board. Then I was one with more expertise, partly because of being a trained biologist, but also because I know the country.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned being insecure and lacking self-confidence. So how did you face that or overcome it?
It's like, I was always fascinated with exploration and especially polar exploration, and people, you know, how did they manage it on their own? And I figured, well, I could do that too. And I was, you know, in Boy Scouts, and I'm in it, outdoor life, and especially in rough, rustic conditions where you make do. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, the woods experience is good. So I was confident in using saws and axes and building fires and cook. And you learn pretty fast to cook for right. yourself.
But did you have the self-confidence in terms of doing the science and collecting the plants and looking at the sheep?
Well, I realized it was somewhat of a learning experience, but also then I realized that I was, in the case of sheep, I was collecting population data that was being used by, his plan was to do a PhD, and he started some residence at the University of British Columbia under the same professor that I did mine in subsequently. But his problem was that he had a couple of problems, but one was that he was spread so thin working here within a limited budget, and he was just top-notch biologist and a pilot himself, and he was super busy. And then he had a family, and so they had the financial difficulties.
This was Dave Spencer or Scott?
Scott.
Scott, okay.
And actually he was among the, he didn't have a PhD, but he had had graduate work in wildlife at Oregon State, which is a good university. Mm-hmm. And his plan was to do this thesis on mountain sheep ecology in Alaska. And he had collected a lot of data, but he didn't have time to work this stuff up. And so he was keeping going some of the studies started, and that's where I came in. The wildlife unit went through the first guy was who became the dean of the university, mm-hmm. Right after he's only there for a couple of years, but he was there on the faculty, and then they hired a professor to teach wildlife, and while he was the first unit leader was there, and then when he became dean, this guy had moved in and became the wildlife unit leader, John Buckley. So he was my major advisor for this mountain goat study, and then he's a top-notch guy, and he was mostly focused on waterfowl and fur bears in the Middle Flats area, and he liked his students to work there because they could all be working together with him.
Right.
He was unhappy with me around work with mountain goats.
Well, I think we will get into all those details in our next interview.
But then, getting to Scott, then Buckley got appointed to a top-notch position in Washington, D.C. with Fish and Wildlife, sort of advisor to the president. And in replacement, Bob Scott was hired to be, he was with Fish and Wildlife, he became unit leader. But he was going through a lot of stress, including his daughter got polio, and then his son had some mental problems, and he was a bit schizophrenic, and he was, and his family life was breaking up. And then he and his wife separated. He became an alcoholic. And then he's such a talented, brilliant guy. He was just top notch with students and as a unit leader. But by this time, I'm working down in Southeast. Mm-hmm. And so I had interaction with him. And I could see that he was in severe trouble. And so they finally, they got frustrated and, you know, he got a lot of warnings. And then they realized the best. And then after he broke up with his wife, then they transferred him to Washington, D.C., where they could keep an eye on him and put much pressure on him. And he straightened up, and he became head of Wildlife Refuges.
That's good.
And then he retired, and he reestablished his relationship with his family and his wife. And things went. Then when he retired from Fish and Wildlife, he took a job with IUCN in Switzerland, Geneva, I think it was, and traveled throughout the world with working with wildlife related stuff.
And that's International Union for the Conservation of Nature.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like that Skilak Lake that summer was pretty exciting.
Yeah. So it was leading up to this last part. We could go on to it more, but Scott was a major mentor.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Spencer was in a different way, and Scott was in a different way. Scott mm-hmm. was a good scientist, but he understood the wild nature of ecology, and he understood me, and I understood him. And so he had a lot of confidence in me, and I was capable of working on my own. Mm-hmm. In those days, you didn't have to have two people, and you didn't have to have a radio and things like that. So I survived.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say it sounds pretty exciting, be out there all by yourself
stuff. And I like being on my own, and I'd like that. I liked being with other people, too, sometimes, you know, he would be flying me out there in a float plane up in the White Mountains, and we'd airdrop food. I'd have some with me, but then I wouldn't airdrop my sleeping bag and some food, I could hike up,
right,
pick up this stuff. So we became pretty confident in how to airdrop, because you can lose stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
And also, we dropped once by a cabin in the Dry Creek headwaters. That was a nice cabin there, and we got permission to use that. And I remember, and I had about a 15-mile walk from where we could land on a wheel plane, and so we dropped this burlap sack with food. And we knew that if you put things in cloth bags, like flour, it was better than to put in a box that might break. And canned goods, if you put them like loose, so they're meat bean bag. And of course, you want them to land going downhill. So you fly over so they bounce downhill rather than boom, right into the ground. And so we dropped this one close to this cabin, and there was this rock. Big rock boulder by the cabin, and it was like an explosion. The flour busted, and it was like it looked like it would actually exploded. It looked like smoke. No, and the only thing that was damaged was the flour.
Oh, well, that's good. You have busted open cans. Yeah. Well, this has been great tonight. Fun stories.
Oh yeah,
those early days of field biology are so different.
And it can. Imagine how I felt when, with people like Dave Spencer and Bob Scott, and getting to do these things I never thought it would be possible in the mountains. I was hooked on the mountains. And from the first time I came here, right?
Yeah.
In the West. I mean, I was too tame back in New England.
All right. Well, I think we will stop for this evening.
Sounds good.